The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. We have no sponsor for this month's program, but we do appreciate all of our past sponsors. If you have any questions or would like to become a sponsor, please contact our office at 919-832-5138. Okay, let's start off with kind of a serious thing here on the Reader's Digest. Safety. Who among us hasn't fished a piece of toast out of the toaster with a fork, figuring, hey, I know I should unplug it, probably won't kill me, or will it? We reveal the danger level of some common careless habits. Will your house kill you? And it shows a picture of a character, can't tell if it's male or female, with a Kiss the Cook sweatshirt on, getting shocked, spilled, stabbed, fell on, cats falling, dogs getting in the oven, I mean, all kinds of crazy stuff. Electrical outlets. If you stick a fork or a bobby pin in one of the sockets, you'll be electrocuted. If you stick something in one of the sockets, you can get a nasty shock. The left sock is connected to the neutral wire. The right is connected to the hot one. And electricity flows from hot to neutral. Sticking something into either slot will disrupt the flow and send it into you. This happens on a surprisingly frequent basis. The National Fire Protection Association, NFPA, reports that 5,500 people went to the emergency room in 2015 with injuries from outlets. If you have newer outlets, they're safer. The National Electrical Code requires new kitchen countertop outlets, and some others, for instance in the bathroom, to be ground fault circuit interrupter outlets, which quickly shuts the currents off if there's an imbalance, because some of the current is leaking into you. But you may still get zapped. Will it kill you? It might. A bolt from a standard 120-volt outlet could trigger cardiac arrest. So if you have heart problems, don't go sticking a fork in a socket. Toasters. The fear. Fishing bread out of the toaster with silverware might electrocute you. The reality. While not many people are electrocuted by small appliances, the Consumer Product Safety Commission estimates 7 deaths a year on average. It's still a bad idea to stick anything besides bread into a toaster, according to the FPA. Even if you unplug it, you could damage the heating element, which could make shock you or start a fire the next time you make toast. Will it kill you? The chances are pretty remote. You largely risk a shock or a burn, not to mention ruining your toasters. Teflon pans. Fear. Bits of Teflon from scratch pans will poison you. The reality. The American Cancer Society says there are no known risks in eating food cooked in Teflon pans, but you do need to worry about letting the pan get too hot. The plastics used in Teflon, called fluoropolymers, begin to break down at 500 degrees Fahrenheit. At around 650, they release at least 6 toxic gases. Breathing in the released fumes can cause respiratory problems and flu-like illness. Will it kill you? Eat your eggs. You'll be fine. Small appliances around water. The fear, if you plug an appliance in while your hands are wet, moisture will transfer the current from the plug to you. The reality. Since water conducts electricity extremely well, and electric currents flow where there is at least resistance, they will usually go through that water and into you, if the opportunity presents itself. Your body is more likely to resist electrical current if your skin is dry. Will it kill you? It could. If your hands are wet when you plug in your iron, you might get a shock. And if your whole body is wet, yes, you could die from a fatal shock to your heart. Silica gel packets. The fear. The gel packs and shipping containers all say, do not eat, so they must be deadly. The reality. The American Association of Poison Control Centers documented 33,705 incidences of people eating silica in 2010, nearly 90% of them involving children under 6, but none died from poisoning because silica is a chemically inert and non-toxic. The real danger is from choking on the packets. Will it kill you? No. But still keep the packets away from young children. Microwave ovens. The fear. Microwaves emit radiation that can cause cancer. The reality. There are two types of radiation. Ionizing radiation, the kind that is emitted after a nuclear explosion, is the bad stuff. Microwave ovens emit non-ionizing radiation, a safer kind and at a low level enough to comply with safety standards. Microwaves operate at about 3 gigahertz, which is fairly low in the electromagnetic spectrum. Will it kill you? No. Go ahead and hover while you wait for that hot pocket. Power lines. The fear. The electromagnetic fields around electric power lines can give you cancer. The reality. A 1979 study found that the incidence of childhood leukemia was higher in Denver neighborhoods near high voltage power lines. But more recent studies show no such correlation. Stepping on a downed live power line is the real threat. Otherwise, you're fine. The electromagnetic waves given off are the safer non-ionizing kind and are extremely low frequency. Will it kill you? No. Power lines are worse for property values than for your health. Gasoline cans. The fear. The container could allow gas to escape and connect with static electricity, causing a spark. The reality. New fuel containers must have flame-arresting screens that prevent heat from getting in, as well as spring-closing lids and spout covers to prevent soilage. Note, your old milk jug has none of those things. The new containers also present little chance of creating a spark, even though the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, warns that static electricity could build up as a result of the gas can sliding around in your truck or truck bed during your travels. Between 2010 and 2016, the Petroleum Equipment Institute, which tracks such things, had no reported incidents of fires caused by static electric discharge. Will it kill you? Not if you're using a proper can, but OSHA recommends that you take it out of your vehicle and set it on the ground before slowly filling it. Cell phones. The fear. Radiation from your phone might cause brain cancer. The reality. The good news is that cell phones, like microwave ovens, give off non-ionizing radiation, the safer kind. Your phone gives off about 2 gigahertz of radiation per second, less than a microwave oven. But few studies have shown increased risk of brain cancer in heavy cell phone users. Will it kill you? Probably not, but research is ongoing. Plastic food containers. The fear. Microwaves pull chemicals out of plastic and allow your food to absorb them. The reality. Bisphenol A, BPA, a chemical found in hard, clear plastic takeout and food storage containers, does leach into your food when microwaved. Although studies have linked it with asthma, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and reproductive problems, among others, the FDA maintains that the amount of BPA in everyday plastics is safe. Will it kill you? No. But you're better off using a non-plastic, glass or ceramic dish labeled microwave safe. Now in the national interest. As wildfires have ravaged so much of the country recently, an air quality specialist discussing how smoke choked her community and offers plans for surviving a fiery future. Wildfire smoke and your health. And there's a picture of a young boy with a real bright red jacket and blue jeans standing there with a mask over his face, so one of those white masks that they have, in an obviously burned out area. It's late August when I get a call from a grandmother. She lives in Sealy Lake, Montana, and she has heard we have air purifiers with high-efficiency particulate, HEPA filters, that can help with smoke. She needs one for the baby's room. I explain we don't have any and tell her how to purchase one. She coughs and goes silent before asking how much they cost. Almost every person I talk to in Sealy Lake has this cough. The family doesn't have much money, she says, but she promises to order a filter for the child. Small filters, ones that can clean a bedroom of up to 75 square feet, cost about $70 each. The next day, the wildfire that has been burning for weeks in the Lodo National Forest, northeast of town, moves closer to the woman's neighborhood, and the county sheriff's office evacuates it. I wonder whether the filter will be there when the family returns home. I know the smoke will be. As an air quality specialist with the Missoula City County Health Department in Montana, it is my job to understand air pollution, control it as much as possible, and help people protect themselves from its effects. I focus on smoke management, issuing permits for outdoor burns, and updating residents about what to expect from the smoke when wildfires send it our way. If my job were only about how smoke moves, it would be simple. Not easy, mind you. Wildfire smoke is flashy and weird. It's just that focusing purely on the science would be fun for a smoke nerd like me. Last July, thunderstorms trekked across western Montana, getting a ring of fire around Missoula County. One by one, they started blowing up, smothering small towns in smoke. The massive Rice Ridge fire burned directly above the community of Sealy Lake, and every night smoke filled the valley, building by the hour and creating dangerous breathing conditions, the likes of which we had never seen. To our south, the Lolo Park fire sent daily smoke to the Bitterroot Valley, frequently creating dangerous, unbreathable air for its residents. Never had we seen so many wildfires so close to home for so many weeks. There are six categories on the Environmental Protection Agency's Air Quality Index: good, moderate, unhealthy for sensitive groups, unhealthy, very unhealthy, and hazardous. Seeley's Lake Air reached hazardous on 18 days last summer. Last year was plagued by wildfires around the country. The blazes that have struck Northern California alone killed 44 people and caused more than $9 billion in damage. But this isn't just a recent problem, nor is it confined to the West. Wildfires hit 49 states in 2017, including a swath from Florida to Virginia. More than 9 million acres burned nationwide, compared with the yearly average of 6.5 million acres. And there's a picture here in the article. It shows an insert of Sarah Cofield, who's the one who wrote the article, dark brown hair, pretty smile, and a picture of apparently an area in Seeley Lake, Montana, where the smoke is so bad, you can probably see 100 yards, maybe 150, really bad. Communities that are nowhere near a wildfire can be affected too. One NOAA NSA satellite showed that the smoke from this past summer's western wildfires traveled along the jet stream as far as New York and Pennsylvania. Sometimes such long-distance smoke merely creates a haze on the horizon. Other times it lands in full force, exposing new areas to potentially dangerous levels of particulate. It's that particulate matter, pollutant so fine that it can enter your bloodstream when you breathe it in, that makes smoke so dangerous. The elderly, people with heart or lung disease, pregnant women, and children are most at risk. Fine particulate comes from sources other than wildfires, too. Smokestacks, cars, power plants, wood stoves, and fireplaces all contribute. In many parts of the country, particularly in New England, a considerable fraction of air pollution comes from wood smoke from homes, especially in the winter. Particulate matter is a cumulative pollutant, so the more you're exposed to it, the worse it is for you. It aggravates asthma symptoms and causes reduced lung function and wheeziness. A recent Harvard University study of Americans aged 65 and older found that when the concentration of particulates rose by just 10 micrograms per cubic meter, the chances that a person would die during the 12 years of the study analyzed increased 7.3%. Those researchers also found that reducing fine particulate pollution by just 1 microgram per cubic meter nationwide could save about 12,000 lives each year. The pollution can be particularly difficult to escape in mountain regions like my part of Montana. When smoke descends on the valley, the world shrinks. Anything more than a block away disappears behind a white wall of smoke. The birds are quiet. Smoke makes its way through the door and window cracks. It follows ventilation systems into homes. Without a filtration system, the indoors provides no refuge. And in rural Montana, where air conditioning is rare, most residents open their windows at night to seek relief from the hot, stuffy summer air, even amid the smoke. The air warms enough in the afternoon to rise and take the smoke with it, providing a few precious hours of respite. But every night it descends, and every morning it stays longer in the valley than it did the day before. In the absence of central air systems, with filtration for fine particulates, the best defense against the smoke is a HEPA filter, which can reduce the fine particulate in a room by more than 99%. But while wildfire smoke has become increasingly common since 2000, HEPA room filters are not yet a standard feature in homes. And when a wildfire moves into your area, the lack of protection can create widespread health problems. The National Ambient Air Quality Standard for Fine Particulate Matter, averaged over 24 hours, is 35 micrograms in a cubic meter of air. During last year's fires, our monitor in Seeley Lake registered 1,000, as high as the machine goes. As the fires burned, I heard from teachers, parents, coaches, healthcare workers, and retirees. They called asking where they could go to escape the smoke. They wanted to know how to protect themselves, what kind of room filters would work, whether they should wear a mask. They pleaded for filters I didn't have. They asked questions I couldn't answer. A child had come home sick from school. Why had the windows been open? The soccer team was expected to play in the smoke. Why hadn't the game been canceled? And there's a graphic here showing a map of the United States, and on that map is superimposed the effect of smoke from the California wildfires, from the wildfires in the West, and it runs a sweep all the way from the West Coast down through the middle of the country, crossing over Indiana, Ohio, Illinois, Kansas, Missouri, Idaho, all those areas, all the way up to southern New York. I mean, it's really a big graph. There was smoke inside the Seeley Lake Clinic. The nurses were sick. A patient in the clinic said the smokes made him want to die. An asthmatic grandmother living in Seeley Lake had just gotten custody of her one-year-old grandson, but she was sick from the smoke and worried for the child. A homebound couple had survived pneumonia 3 times that year, and the husband was on oxygen. They were a mile from the fire. "Please help," they asked. "I tried." Some are questioned easier than others. I tracked down school athletic directors to make sure the people arranging soccer games followed the correct guidance. If the air quality was rated as unhealthy or worse, cancel the games. I pulled up a map and figured out how close the cleanest air was so some people could try to escape the smoke for a short period of time. I looked at weather patterns and models that made projections about when the smoke would likely to clear or worsen. I shared information about HEPA room filters and explained how they could help create a safe space, usually a bedroom in a home. But the smoke in Seeley Lake thickened on a daily basis. I talked to my supervisors. We sent out an official recommendation that residents leave the area until the smoke cleared. Few took our advice. Few had anywhere else to go. I called the director of Climate Smart Missoula, which has launched a pilot project to provide HEPA room filters to the elderly, and pleaded for help. They came through with 25 filters for the health clinic patients. I called state agency and asked for money to buy filters, but was left empty-handed. I called the Seeley Lake and Lolo elementary schools to ask whether they had filtered air for their students. They didn't. We raided our health department budget and purchased 40 HEPA room filters for the schools. The manufacturer gave us a discount, cutting their retail price from $170 to $127. Climate Smart Missoula ordered 45 more with support from the community. When children's health is at risk, the director explained, you don't wait on details. I called my contact at the American Lung Association, and she immediately contacted headquarters. They had some money, but I sent it to the next county over where, on that day, the need was greater. I took calls from surrounding counties asking what to do. I sent them what information I had. I began shuffling filters and trying to find filters on a near daily basis. There was an elementary school in Condon where 23 students were sitting in smoke so thick that visibility had dropped to less than half a mile. We sent them 8. One day I received 3 requests for filters I didn't have, 2 for babies and 1 for a choking elderly couple. I took their information and promised to try to help. Then I put my head in my hands and wept. Throughout it all, I sent updates about the smoke, where it was going, how bad it would get, how people could protect themselves. I sprinkled the updates with smoke jokes because my survival mechanism, and maybe it would help others. People tell me it does. But every night, while I lie in bed with my filter gently whirring beside me, I know there are vulnerable people sleeping unprotected. And I know, in another year, in another valley, the smoke will come back. I take comfort knowing that when it does, we won't have to scramble. After weeks of frantic activity, we've laid the groundwork to protect our communities from smoke, educating the public, creating safe spaces for vulnerable residents, building a reserve supply of filters, and we've seen our efforts expand through western Montana. To our knowledge, our push to get HEPA filters into the community last summer was a first in the country, and currently I'm in talks with the Environmental Protection Agency about packaging what we did here for other communities in the United States. Every bit of preparedness helps. And here's a sidebar. How to protect yourself from smoke. Sometimes you can't see smoke, but that doesn't mean it's not there, and it could be dangerous. You can find out for sure by checking the smoke advisory section of airnow.gov. If smoke is affecting your area, there are several ways to protect yourself. At home, the best HEPA purifier will filter the smallest particles possible, down to 0.3 microns. I recommend using a HEPA filter in your bedroom at night, since it's generally the longest period of time you'll spend in one room, advised Sarah Cofield. To make sure that it's powerful enough to be effective, check the clean air delivery rate, CADR number. The CADR tells you the volume of air being filtered. Choose one that can handle at least 2/3 of your room's area. So, for example, a CADR of at least 80 is needed to clear a 125-square room. That's a 10x12 room. Outside, a respirator face mask keeps smoke out. But check with your doctor before you get one. Folks with heart or lung conditions could actually find it more difficult to breathe with the barrier created by a mask. The NIOSH-rated respirator face mask, labeled N95 or N100, sold at hardware stores for about $10, filters at least 95% of fine airborne particulates. A mask with two straps ensures a snug fit over your nose and under your chin. A paper mask or one with only one strap won't keep smoke out, and neither will a wet towel or a bandana. In the car, keep your windows and vents closed and turn on the air conditioner in recirculate mode to keep the air inside your car as clean as possible. Who knew? Nature's most basic color palette supplies its owners with a surprising array of survival techniques. Why so many animals wear black and white coats? Think of flamboyance in the animal kingdom, and a colorful menagerie springs to mind, a parrot's rainbow plumage or the showy scales of a tropical fish. Mammals tend to be less vibrant than other animal groups, but that doesn't mean they are less visually distinctive. In fact, many of the most striking beasts on the planet come in only two colors, black and white. Despite the basic palette, these high-contrast markings represent some of nature's most diverse of evolutionary choices. For some mammals, black and white coloring is a way to warn off predators. For others, it's an insect repellent. For still others, it creates a clever cloak. Spend some time exploring what science has discovered about these animals' appearances, and you'll see that basic black and white isn't so basic after all. Skunk. Defense mechanism. Depending on the species, black skunks may wear white spots that act as camouflage or white stripes that signal enemies to beware their smelly spray. And if you've never smelled a skunk, you don't really want to. Giant panda. A complex patchwork. Recent insights into panda coloring have come from studying each body part separately. Black ears indicate ferocity, and distinct eye patches in an individual recognition. The panda's white body camouflages it against snow, while its dark limbs help it hide in forest, a compromise derived from its poor bamboo diet. Bamboo doesn't let pandas build up enough fat to hibernate, forcing them to spend winters in the snow. Badger. Ferocious mask. Even when a badger is crouched in its burrow, its bold facial stripes can be seen. Geologists say the warning coloration helps the small mammal deter predators. Badgers are pretty mean, though. Zebra. No-bite stripes. Zebras' thin coats make them more vulnerable to long-haired animals to biting flies that carry disease. But the coats stripe deter flies from landing on zebras, for a reason that scientists are still investigating. A black buck male, shadow caster. In bright sun, the buck's white stomach counteracts the shadow cast by his back, allowing him to appear one color and two-dimensional, essentially hiding from predators in his own shadow. Okay, since that's the last article we had under this month's Reader's Digest, let's go back to the Consumer Reports, which we started last week on recalls. And I listed last week, use your car to recall and you don't know it. About one of every four recalled vehicles on the U.S. roads now hasn't been fixed. So here's a listing of those they list, or the Consumer Reports has listed. And if your listed car or truck is on this list, you really need to get it checked with your dealer. A Ram 1500, 2500, and 3500 pickup trucks. Ram is recalling about 1.5 million pickup trucks. Mostly the heavy-duty models, because of a problem with the gear shifter, which is mounted on the steering column. The recall doesn't apply to vehicles with a rotary dial or floor-mounted shifter, or to trucks built after December 31, 2016. The automaker said the shifter can't be moved out of park even if the brake isn't being depressed, or in some cases if the key isn't in ignition, causing the truck to move unexpectedly, especially if the parking brake isn't engaged. What the owner should do: always use your parking brake as recommended. You can call 866-220-6747 for more information about the recall. If necessary, schedule an appointment with your local dealer to correct the problem. 2015 to 2017 Ford F-100 and Super Duty pickups. Ford has recalled 1.1 million 2015 to 2017 F-100 pickup trucks and 2017 Ford Super Duty trucks because the doors might not open or close properly. According to Ford, the problem is caused by a frozen door latch or a bent or kinked actuator cable. The company has warned owners that the latch might not fully engage the door striker, leaving the potential for the door to open while the truck is in motion. What owners should do? Contact your local Ford dealer. Use reference number 17533 to see whether your vehicle is part of the recall. Ford will make any necessary repairs at no cost to you. By the way, I know most of our listeners don't drive, but your family members certainly do. So if any of these cars are in your family, please go ahead and call and get them taken care of. 2006-2011 BMW 3 Series cars. BMW is recalling more than 670,000 3 Series cars from 2006 to 2011 because the wiring and electrical connectors for the heating and air conditioning system can deteriorate and overheat, potentially causing a fire, even if the car isn't running. What owners could do? Contact BMW customer service at 1-800-525-7417 to see whether your car is part of the recall. BMW will replace the wiring harness and possibly other parts, if necessary, at no cost to you. 2014 to 2016, Kia Soul and Soul EV SUVs. Kia is recalling 342,381 previously recalled Kia Soul SUVs over a steering issue, because the first repair may not have been done properly, according to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. The affected vehicles may have a flawed steering gear assembly, and if not repaired correctly, the driver could lose control of the car. Drivers of affected vehicles will probably hear a clunking noise from the steering rack when the steering wheel is being turned. What owners should do? Contact Kia Consumer Affairs at 1-800-333-4542 or your dealer. Using reference number 17V608000 to find out whether your vehicle is affected, Kia will make all repairs free of charge. 2005 to 2007, 2000 to 2010, Toyota Sienna minivans. Toyota has recalled 310,000 Sienna minivans built from 2005, 2007, and 2009 and 2010 after discovering a problem with the shifting lever, which can be moved out of park when the brake pedal isn't engaged. If this occurs, the vehicle could roll away, running the risk of a crash. What owners should do? Call Toyota at 800-331-4331 to find out whether your Sienna is part of the recall. Toyota will replace the necessary parts at no cost. 2017 Chrysler Pacifica minivans. Fiat Chrysler is recalling 153,859 Pacifica minivans because they can stall in some situations. Fiat Chrysler said that most such events reportedly occur at idle or while starting, turning, or driving at low, steady speeds. Most drivers were able to restart their cars. This doesn't really affect hybrid versions of the Pacifica. The owner should do. Call customer service at 800-853-1403 to find out whether your van is part of the recall, and if so, how to schedule a service appointment. Dealers will install updated software free of charge. Going the distance, the race to improve fuel economy. Thanks to consumer demand, government pressure, and manufacturer innovations, cars have been going farther. Been going farther on every gallon of gas for more than a decade. But is a revived debate over efficiency requirements going to slow progress? For Christy Mulkey, a Texas businesswoman, government fuel economy rules are more than dry numbers and technical jargon. Money saved from the improved efficiency of her truck fleet improves her bottom line and helps pay for richer employee bonuses. As CEO of Diverse Construction, one of the state's few female-owned communications contractors, Mulkey sweats the fuel expense for her 15 work trucks. They're mostly big, brawny Chevrolet pickups of various sizes, some strong enough to haul 18-foot trailers fully loaded with tools and materials for building and maintaining cell towers. Mulkey has noticed fuel efficiency notching up in recent years as she rotates to new trucks. The improved efficiency saves Diverse, based in Louisville, about 20% on its fuel bill. Last year, it was about $135,000, Mulkey says. A few years ago, the fleet was averaging 6 to 8 miles per gallon. Now it's more like 9 to 10. We can tell it's improving, she says. Every little bit helps. Many other business owners and consumers are reaping the rewards of industry innovation, spurred by a government push on fuel economy. The Obama administration set new efficiency targets in 2011 and 2012, after negotiating with the auto industry in the wake of General Motors and Chrysler bankruptcies. Mulkey's trucks, like most U.S. vehicles produced in the 2000s, have benefited from advances gained in the face of tougher government rules. But as a recovered industry now sells vehicles at near-record clip, these targets are under attack. Car companies want relief from the goals they say are increasingly expensive and unrealistic, and the Trump administration is openly skeptical of these regulations. Weak U.S. demand for hybrids and all-electric vehicles is Exhibit A for the industry, as it argues by its position. But consumer and environmental groups, among others, argue that automakers don't need huge increases in EV sales to meet targets. Continued advances in gas and diesel-powered engines should be enough. They also stress that keeping targets in place is a key because it forces automakers to innovate. There's a whole set of engineering opportunities, says John DeCoco, a professor of University of Michigan, who researches auto technology and its effects on global climate. So far, there's no evidence that automakers have been given too tough of a job. Mulkey, whose personal car is an all-electric Tesla Model S, says regulators need to keep pressure on manufacturers. It saves us money, he says. It helps to be able to pass those dollars on to our employees. New targets should come this spring, when regulators are expected to propose changes to federal fuel efficiency rule, known as the Corporate Average Fuel Economy, CAFE standards. There's a lot at stake. If mile-per-gallon targets are put on hold, the planet could see more carbon dioxide emissions, and U.S. consumers could miss out on the financial benefits of more efficient vehicles. On the flip side, vehicles could cost less to produce if manufacturers don't see the need to invest in fuel economy improvements, and those savings might be passed on to car buyers. Fuel economy standards are working, and the consumers are better off as a result, says David Friedman, Director of Cars and Product Policy and Analysis for Consumers Union, the Advocacy Division of Consumer Reports. Vehicles continue to hit record highs in fuel efficiencies as automaker innovations have consumer money at the pump. Consumers simply can't afford for these standards to be weakened at the request of automakers. Design for efficiency. So what's behind the fuel economy advances? For the most part, it's a combination of improvements in engines, transmissions, aerodynamics, and weight reduction. There's a bad word here. Not a profane word, but it's in a bad place. Automaker. Engineers are using high-powered computers to improve designs as well as gas and diesel performance. Take this redesigned 2019 Toyota Avalon, unveiled in January at the North American International Auto Show in Detroit. Randy Stevens, chief engineer at Toyota Technical Center, says engineers considered CAFE, CAFE standards, when creating the model. They shaved weight, selected more fuel-efficient tires, and refined aerodynamics. They also improved the 0 to 60 mph acceleration because buyers demanded it, he says. Toyota hasn't released the new miles per gallon number. CR tested the 2016 Avalon at 24 miles per gallon overall. We feel quite a bit of pressure to make sure we're increasing fuel economy, Stevens says. We felt the need to be competitive on horsepower, too. If you haven't been to a dealership lately, you might be in for a pleasant sticker shock. The average fuel economy for all U.S. cars, SUVs, and light trucks had increased by 12% to 25.2 miles per gallon in 2017 from 22.6 miles per gallon in 2010. The 2010 Honda Accord, four-cylinder, for example, was rated by the Environmental Protection Agency at 21 miles per gallon for city and 31 miles per gallon for highway. The 2018 version, four-cylinder turbo equivalent, is 30 miles per hour per gallon in the city and 38 miles per gallon on the highway, increases of 43 and 23% respectively. In CR testing, the Ford F-150 improved to an overall 19 miles per gallon for the 2018 model from 14 miles per gallon in 2004, a 36% increase. At the same time, the truck's 0 to 60 acceleration improved to 6.8 seconds from 8.3 seconds. Automakers have big strides in the last decade because engineers bring fuel-saving designs to the marketplace quicker now, says John German, an engineer who works for Chrysler, Honda, and the EPA, before joining the International Council on Clean Transportation as a senior fellow. If technology were the same today as it was in 2012, you might be able to make the argument that some kind of modest rollback to the standards would be appropriate, he says. But the technology is improving at such a rapid rate. The impact of our SUV nation. To be sure, consumers have demanded better fuel economy for financial and environmental reasons, and the industry has been making the smart business choice to give them what they want. So why would the industry want to backslide now? Automakers say it's a more complex equation than many in Washington and across the nation realize, involving changing consumer tastes toward pickup trucks and SUVs. They say that U.S. car buyers aren't embracing electrified vehicles and hybrids enough for the industry to realistically meet current CAFE standards, a formula based on an automaker's mix of vehicles. For a company selling 48% cars and 52% light trucks and SUVs, the current target is an equivalent to a fleet average of 47.5 miles per gallon by 2025. After automakers use credits and the ideal condition of the laboratory are accounted for, the real-world target works out to 35.5 miles per gallon. Cheaper gas could be working against the goal, helping renew America's love affair with larger vehicles. Pickups, SUVs, and other light trucks now account for more than half of all U.S. sales. In December, the three Detroit-era automakers totaled 722,822 vehicles, and 592,665 of them were pickups, SUVs, or minivans. Only 18% were cars. The shift in demand has been happening for a while, but has now become a tsunami. There's only so much new fuel efficiency you can squeeze out of SUVs and trucks by shaving weight and improving aerodynamics, says Mark Chernobi, Chief Technical Compliance Officer at Fiat Chrysler Automobiles. You won't get the 2025 standards without significantly higher penetration of electrification than we have today, he says. We're talking about a huge increase. But just because an automaker builds a super-efficient new hybrid or electric vehicle doesn't mean consumers will buy it. In fact, hybrid sales have remained weak overall. Last year, sales were estimated 4% of the whole U.S. market. Rick Giselle, National Manager of Technical and Regulatory Affairs at Toyota, says the industry is proud of its steady fuel efficiency gain, but is concerned the conventional technologies aren't going to be enough. Fuel economy is an important attribute. I think this notion that the consumers will take fuel economy over all other things is a bit of a fallacy, because we all have limited budgets, Giselle says. At the end of the day, you're making trade-offs. The EPA came to a different conclusion in the 2000 technical report. It concluded that the automakers could meet the 2025 CAFE targets without much help from hybrid or EV sales because of rapid progress in traditional fuel technologies, such as turbocharging, fuel injection, and engine efficiency. Luke Tonashell, Director of Clean Vehicles and Fuels at Natural Resource Defense Council, points out that the auto industry has been achieving record sales and profits even as it complains about the strain of reaching current fuel economy targets. There's been a huge benefit to consumers, he says. Choices for consumers have been great under these standards. Rolling back the standards would disrupt that innovation. Debate over government rules. For more than four decades, auto industry's progress on fuel economy, or lack thereof, has been driven by government regulations. The CAFE program dates to an oil crisis in the early 1970s, when gasoline prices shot up after the Arab oil embargo. Policymakers saw fuel economy as a national security concern and required automakers to build more efficient cars. The original CAFE standards called for doubling the average efficiency for passenger cars from less than 14 miles per gallon in 1975 to 27.5 miles per gallon 10 years later. Politics changed when gas prices plummeted in the 1980s and throughout the 1990s. The industry successfully lobbied Congress to freeze CAFE standards in the mid-1990s. From 2003 to 2010, there were some small adjustments higher. At the same time, evidence of climate change was building, and environmental groups in several states, including Massachusetts and California, successfully sued the EPA under the Clean Air Act to regulate carbon dioxide as a polluter. After a sharp increase in gas prices and the Great Recession of 2008-2009, the Obama administration and California negotiated higher fuel targets with the auto industry. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, and the EPA are expected to release a joint plan this spring updating the rules. Consumer Union, the Advocacy Division of Consumer Reports, is urging Congress and regulators to maintain or strengthen the current standards. Jim Farley, Executive Vice President of Global Markets at Ford, says the automaker is in favor of stringent requirements. In general, we think it's a healthy thing to look at how customers are making decisions and what these new standards mean for everything from affordability to how much they're actually reducing greenhouse gases, he said in a January interview with the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. He declined to say where long-term fuel economy should be set. General Motors spokesman Laura Toole told CR in an email that improving miles per gallon and reducing greenhouse gas emissions was an unwavering goal for the automaker. It's the right thing to do, but it has to be done right, Toole said. She declared that she declined to address specific questions about GM's position on CAFE standards. Is the future electric? Consumer Report predicts even more improvements are on the way through better technology, but only if strong standards remain in place. Analysis from Consumer Reports and government agencies, among others, shows that improving miles per gallon saves drivers money, even when gas prices are low and even after accounting for higher technology costs. CR tests new vehicles, including an assessment of new fuel efficiency features at our track in Connecticut and on public roads. If current trends continue, consumers could see leaps in innovation in coming years, says Friedman, adding that after years of trying, car companies, including Mazda and Toyota, say they're on the verge of bringing diesel-like efficiency to gasoline engines. Mitch Bainwall, CEO of the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, the industry's leading trade group, says automakers are concerned about affordability. If you jam standards in that are ahead of the marketplace, you drive up costs, he says. He thinks the danger of the future hybrid EVs and other high mile-per-gallon cars will end up sitting unsold on dealer lots. But even as auto companies point to the soft demand for hybrid and all-electric vehicles, more car makers have announced plans to build electrified models. Some analysis say it's a reaction to global developments. In China, the world's largest vehicle market is pushing domestic EV sales to address its air pollution problems. The U.S. is no longer the biggest or most influential automotive market, says Ed Kim, analyst with Auto Pacific. Also, some cities and countries in Europe have announced plans to de-emphasize gas and diesel-powered engines in the coming decades. There's also the Tesla factor. The Silicon Valley company has shown there's a market for high-end all-electric sedans and SUVs. The company's surging stock prices encourage new players in the market. Ramping up electric vehicle sales is the holy grail for automakers operating in the U.S. If consumers bought EVs in large numbers, it would free up automakers to sell higher horsepower trucks and SUVs and also meet CAFE's targets. But tepid EV sales are a reality. Even so, German, the ICCT fellow, says it won't take an electrified revolution to meet goals. The internal combustion engine has been castigated for years as inefficient, but the inefficiency has also been an opportunity, he says. They're figuring out ways to dramatically increase the number of miles you get from that gallon of gas. Fuel-saving innovations. Not every fuel-saving technology is a complete reinvention of the traditional internal combustion engine. Hybrid electric and fuel cell cars have potential to change the way we power vehicles in the U.S., but there have been many smaller innovations that are saving fuel right now. Here are some features that work and some that still need tweaking. Engine upgrades. Cylinder deactivation. What it is, shuts off multiple engine cylinders while the vehicle is cruising or coasting. How it saves fuel. Deactivated cylinders don't use fuel when the engine is coasting or when the vehicle has a low demand for driving power. What to watch out for. In some older models, the engine might vibrate when all the cylinders fire back up. Which automakers do it well? GM, Honda, and Chrysler. Which automakers don't? None. Smaller turbocharged engines. What they are. These engines are forced air to boost their power when needed, giving them horsepower usually found in larger non-turbo engines. How they save fuel. Smaller, more efficient engines replace larger ones using less fuel. what to watch out for. Many suffer from an initial hesitation due to turbo lag, and sometimes expected fuel economy savings aren't realized. Which automakers do them well? Audi, BMW, Ford F-150, Honda, and Volkswagen. Which makers don't? Ford Focus, Fusion, and Escape. Excuse me, got to turn the page here. Start-stop technology. What it is? It shuts the engine off when the vehicle comes to a stop. How it saves fuel? By not letting the engine idle when it's not needed. What to watch out for? Some systems have a notable shutter when they power back up. Some vehicles hesitate when they restart, leaving drivers momentarily flat-footed and unable to merge quickly into traffic. And some systems shut down the air conditioning along with the engine, which can make passengers in the cabin uncomfortable during warm weather. Which automakers do it well? BMW, Chevrolet, Cruze and Malibu, Honda Odyssey, Toyota Sienna, Ford F-150. Which automakers don't? Alfa Romeo, Jaguar Land Rover, and Cadillac. Direct injection. What it is? Fuel is fed directly into each engine cylinder instead of the intake manifold. How it saves fuel. It improves efficiency because the amount of gasoline can be ejected more precisely. What to watch out for? Loud engine clatter could occur in some older vehicles. They're also prone to carbon buildup, which requires regular maintenance every couple of years to avoid rough idling and loss of power. Which automakers do it well? Many. This is a widespread feature. Which automakers don't? None. Early problems have been largely overcome. Transmission advances. 8, 9, and 10 speed transmissions. What they are? Automatic transmission with as many as 8, 9, or 10 gears. How they save fuel? The more gears a transmission has, the more likely that the engine is working at peak efficiency. This means it uses less fuel to generate power. What to watch out for? Some are poorly tuned and don't shift smoothly or don't respond promptly enough, so drivers have to match the accelerator to get the power they want. This can make a car feel pokey or suffer from jerky gear shift, and some owners reported reliability issues. Which automakers do them well? Audi, BMW, Chrysler 8-speed, Jenison 8-speed, Honda 10-speed. What automakers don't? Jeep 9-speed, Honda Acura 9-speed. Dual-clutch transmissions. What they are? Essentially, these have the mechanical guts of a manual transmission, but the gear changes and the clutch operation are executed electronically. How they save fuel? Fuel economy is improved because less power is lost between the engine and the wheels. Because it doesn't have a torque converter, there's a more direct connection between the engine and the wheels. What to watch out for? They usually hesitate when accelerating from a stop or vibrate in stop-and-go crawl. Many allow the vehicle to roll backwards when starting at an incline. Owners have reported reliability problems with some dual-clutch transmissions. What automakers do them well? Audi, Volkswagen, and Porsche. Which automakers don't? Ford Focus and Fiesta, Hyundai Tucson 1.67. Continuously variable transmissions. What they are? In essence, CVTs allow an almost infinite number of gears as opposed to a defined set, typically found in an automatic transmission. That allow drivers to get the power they need when they need it, whether it's passing power instantly or low-effort highway cruising. How they save fuel? Because they're always in the right ratio, CVTs optimize fuel economy and acceleration. What to watch out for? Because the engine may be revving at a higher rate over longer periods than with conventional automatic transmissions, CVTs can amplify engine noise. They can also require more frequent and sometimes expensive service compared with conventional automatic transmissions. Which automakers do them well? Honda and Subaru. Which automakers don't? Nissan, Versa, and Sentra. Weight reduction and tire tweaks. Aerodynamics improvements. What they are? Automakers are tweaking the slope of hoods, windshields, and rear ends, and adding technology like grill shutters, underbody panels, and wheel covers. How they save fuel? Sleeker shapes and fewer openings help a vehicle cut through the air more easily. What to watch out for? Some active systems may require extra maintenance. Would automakers do this well? All. These efforts have been underway for years. Low rolling resistance tires. What they are? Tires that create less friction with the road. How they save fuel. They require less power to roll, reducing work for the engine and helping to save fuel. What to watch out for? Sometimes the lack of resistance translates into a lack of grip, which can increase wet hopping distances and lead to a shorter tread life, which tire makers do it well. Bridgestone, Firestone, Goodyear, and Michelin market three these fuel-saving tires. Which makers don't? Some car companies and replacement tire makers offer more fuel-efficient tires, but some of those come with compromises to tread life and grip on wet surfaces. And weight reduction. What it is, automakers are dropping items such as spare tires and using stronger steel, aluminum, and other high-strength materials to keep the weight down. How it saves fuel. Every pound cuts less weight the engine has to move. What to watch out for? This can result in less supportive seats, thinner glass, and fewer sound-deadening materials, which can mean a noisier, less comfortable cabin. Which automakers do it well? Ford, Honda, Mazda, and Mercedes-Benz. Which automakers don't? Few today. Most work hard to avoid making consumers suffer from weight reductions. Are trucks becoming the new family car? Today's pickups are safer and more comfortable, and sales to women and families are on the rise. Could one be right for you? Pickup truck sales are the hottest they've been in a decade. And it's no wonder. Driving one is no longer a bumpy, jarring experience that you have to endure. Truck makers today are building pickups with broader appeal, with a softer ride and more safety, convenience, and comfort features. As a result, pickups are now attracting more buyers, including those who like the addition of back seats and more cab space, and don't seem to mind sacrificing some bed length for extra room inside. Although the pickup market remains overwhelmingly dominated by male buyers, the number of women who registered full-size pickups increased 67% from 2008 to 2016, reaching more than 470,000 trucks in 2016, based on data from the IHS market. Family trucks are 40 to 50% of our mix, says David Eisenhoff, Ram brand spokesman in the industry. A family truck is one with four full-size doors and a mid-level or higher trim. Additional seating has been a trend for over 10 years, and those bigger cabs mean more space for adults as well as kids, says Jen Stockberger, Director of Operations at Consumer Reports Auto Test Center in Connecticut. In our test, crew cab pickups typically offer generous rear seat room to install child seats, she says. But the space needed for those seats means a trade-off in the size of the pickup beds. 20 years ago, the Ford F-150's most popular combination was a regular cab with an 8-foot bed, according to Mill Yu, CR's automatic and automotive analyst. Today, the cabs are a lot bigger and the beds are smaller. Consumers don't seem to mind. General Motors says the most popular combo now is a Chevrolet Silverado i5-1500 is a crew cab with a 5-foot 8-inch bed, the shortest available. Family-friendly changes. Shoppers who choose a pickup as a family vehicle bring different needs to the segment than traditional buyers, says GM spokesman Nick Richards. Core truck capabilities such as handling, towing, and off-road ability are still priorities, he says, but exterior appearance, safety, and technology are now more important than ever. It also doesn't hurt that pickups sit fairly high off the ground with acres of glass, giving drivers a good view of the world outside, and though the long and tall hoods can make parking situations a challenge. Ford has been evolving its F-150 for years, offering larger cab options, a quiet interior, and more luxury features. Given the versatility of today's trucks, more are being utilized as primary family vehicles, says Don McKenzie, a Ford spokeswoman. True luxury pickups are a real thing, too. Hop into a high-end truck these days and you'll find leather seats, power-adjustable pedals, soft-closing tailgates, powerful infotainment systems, and multi-zone climate control. Ram says demand for its high-end trims have doubled since 2009 to 20% of the mix. Among vehicles that cost more than $50,000, full-size pickups are some of the most popular, says Gabriel Sinbar, Associate Director of the Auto Test Program at CR. These are $60,000-plus vehicles with amenities and swagger. Despite the embrace by more families, the pickup truck segment hasn't been as quick to adopt advanced safety systems as cars and SUVs. Toyota leads the pack by putting standard automatic emergency braking, AEB, forward collision warning, FCW, and lane departure warning, LDW, on its 2018 Tundra full-size and Tacoma compact pickups. AEB and FCW aren't standard on the 2018 Ford 150, but they're available, along with blind spot warning, BSW, rear cross traffic warning, RCTW, LDW, and lane keeping assist, LKA. On the 2018 Chevrolet Silverado, AEB, FCW, LDW, and LKA are available, but not BSW or RCW. The 2018 Ram 1500 lags the most in this area, lacking any advanced safety features. That will change with the 2018 redesign, which makes all those features available, along with a 360-degree camera. Although pickups can be gas guzzlers, automakers have improved truck mile per gallon by using more efficient engines and transmissions, and by reducing weight. The Ram 1500 EcoDiesel is currently the most fuel-efficient full-size pickup, managing 20 miles per gallon overall in CR's testing. The F-150 gallon gasoline's 2.7-liter V6 turbo gets an impressive 19 miles per gallon overall. Ford's 150 dropped 700 pounds when it switched to an all-aluminum body, and Ford is adding a diesel version later in 2018 that the company says could reach 30 highway miles per gallon. Smart buying advice. Pickup trucks have become more civilized, but make no mistake, they still don't ride or handle as well as cars or SUVs. Most have a higher step-in and are more difficult to park. So unless you really need an open bed, a truck might not be for you, especially in an urban living situation. If you're buying a pickup for the first time, be careful not to get more truck than you need. The brawnier the truck, the more it can cost you in fuel. The burlier ones can tend to have higher step-ups, and the ride comfort will suffer. For instance, if you're not planning to frequently carry heavy loads or pull a big trailer, you probably don't need a heavy-duty truck, 3/4 ton or more. Stick with a light-duty version, half-ton, 1500 size. Even a compact truck, such as a Chevrolet Colorado, a Honda Ridgeline, or the upcoming Ford Ranger, could fit the bill. If you rarely haul dirty cargo, large appliances, or motorcycles, then a minivan or an SUV might be the better choice. If you only truly need a pickup once in a while for a specific task, then you might be better off renting on those occasions. And to close us out, I was sent to Japan by the Defense Language Institute Foreign Language Center to work with an American linguist. One day I contacted the operator and said I wanted to call Monterey, California. "How do you spell it?" she asked. I said, "M is in Massachusetts, O is in Oregon, N is in Nevada." "Wait, please," said the operator. "How do you spell Massachusetts?" And we've run out of time for today's broadcast of the Reader's Digest of Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleredingservice.org. If you'd like to thank all of our past sponsors for their generous contributions to the reading service. If you have any comments or questions or would like to be a sponsor, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. So long until